Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear arguments from petitioners in State versus Bicker.
May I please report tomorrow my turn to set arguments for petitioners. If you have reserved 5 minutes, we'll vote.
May I please report, Mr. Adler, Mr. Anderson. My name is Mark Heidenheimer, and I represent the state of Texas in this matter through the Office of the Attorney General. The issue before the court today is whether a private landowner has a constitutionally protected right that entitles it to force the state to exchange the state's real property against the state's wishes. In order to fully understand this case, it's important to recognize that there are two separate legal disputes that involve the subject property that was a part of this lawsuit. The first legal dispute, which is not in front of the court today, but which is important to note in order to understand the issues that are before the court today, is that a separate condemnation process and legal dispute was ensuing between the county and the landowners involving the subject property. In order to widen 2222, the county had entered into a written agreement with the state that the county would acquire the land necessary to widen and straighten 2222 at no expense to the state of Texas. 5 days before the case that's in front of you went to jury trial, the county settled with the landowners. In that settlement, they agreed on a certain amount of money to be paid by the county for the land to be acquired to build the project. And the landowners agreed that that would settle the dispute about the amount of money for the land acquired, and that that settlement would also settle any dispute in this lawsuit. They were dropping the lawsuit 5 days before the case went to jury trial. The opinion of the Court of Appeals does note this fact by stating that the county bid on the land and that the landowners rejected the county's bid. That's, Justice Smith writes that at the very beginning of the opinion. It's one of the first paragraphs. You can find it when you look at it. So she does acknowledge in her opinion the fact that this separate legal dispute was ensuing. Clearly, the landowners were compensated for the land physically taken through the dispute that involved the condemnation process. Clearly, they were compensated. Their fundamental right to be compensated for land taken was met at that time when the county entered this settlement. Now, the second legal dispute involving the same land involves the legal issue of whether an inverse condemnation occurred as to the remainder property. The landowners claim that because an easement exchange did not go through, that the market value of their remaining property was greatly diminished. And they claim that when the state refused to make that easement exchange, that amounted to an inverse condemnation. Most importantly, in terms of the legal issues presented in this case before the court, it is the concept of inverse condemnation upon which the Court of Appeals relied in awarding the landowners $1.5 million in damages. I'd like to address the issue of inverse condemnation now that we've talked about the direct condemnation legal dispute.
If the state withheld the easement exchange for the purpose, it decided, and there's no question about it, that he decided to do that for the purpose of holding the value down so that compensation due in eminent domain would be less, would it be liable for inverse condemnation?
Given the facts of the case at bar, the answer is absolutely no, and I'd like to talk about that, Justice Hayes.
But, I mean, as an abstract matter of law, it wouldn't be liable under any circumstances.
That's correct, and I'd like to explain why. This gets into the equal protection argument, which the Court of Appeals did not actually rely upon, but it's extremely important that I address this issue to the court, because my greatest concern standing up here at this very moment is the appearance of impropriety on the part of the state, and that is the key that has created the confusion at the jury trial level and created confusion at the Court of Appeals level. There's two things to be considered dealing with equal protection. Number one, was the same process used and applied by the state of Texas in reviewing their request for an easement exchange as that of other people that requested it? Now, I want to emphasize, this is assuming that equal protection applies. It's the state's position that because of 6673A, it does not create an equal protection right, because 6673A gives the state a mechanism to dispose of its surplus property that the state, in its discretion, determines the surplus. But for a moment, under a worst-case scenario from the point of view of the state, I want to assume that they unequivocally have an equal protection right because of 6673A. And Justice Hecht, I would urge, even assuming they have an equal protection right, that the state still has complied with equal protection requirements of both the state and federal constitutions for the following reasons. Two reasons. Number one, the same process was applied to these landowners as anyone else who requests an exchange of easements. As Mr. Murray testified at the trial court in front of the jury, there are several steps that must be employed in order for an exchange to take place. One of those requirements is that a formal resolution from the county commissioner's court be passed in which the county commissioners find that this land is surplus to the needs of the citizens of the county. Until and unless that occurs, no exchange has ever happened in the state of Texas. And on one of the two exchanges that Mr. Murray gave as an example in the statement of facts, I had the foresight to ask him if, in fact, that resolution had been passed. And as a matter of fact, in each and every instance in which there has been an exchange, that requirement was met in order for the exchange to occur. In the case at bar, Mr. Murray was led to believe by both oral communications and written communications from the county attorney's office that that resolution would not be forthcoming from the commissioner's court because it was the county's opinion that it wasn't surplus to the needs of the county. And I'd like to direct your attention to two places in the record that I didn't quote in my brief that you and your clerks can look at involving Charles Murray's testimony, the right-of-way supervisor for the state of Texas. That statement of facts, Roman numeral 3 of Roman numeral 6, page 615, line 19, through page 616, line 5. And then in that same volume, page 619, line 8, through page 620, line 8. What Mr. Murray says there is he had a telephone conversation with a county attorney. Based on that telephone conversation, he was under the impression that a resolution would not be forthcoming. He asked the county attorney to send him a letter. The county attorney's supervisor sent the letter, who was not a party to the telephone conversation. And the letter was somewhat equivocal, but Mr. Murray stated in front of the jury and in the record that taking the telephone conversation in conjunction with the letter, it was his impression and understanding that a resolution from the county commissioner's court would not be forthcoming.
If that opinion of the commissioner's court was shaped by the idea that they could hold compensation down on this property, would that give rise to liability and inverse condemnation?
No, sir.
The state, why doesn't the state do this all the time? This is a gold mine. You could just rezone property to whatever the worst use it could possibly be and then go in there and condemn it as having a low value.
Okay. I'm going to seize upon the word rezone. That gets to another problem, and that is the Garrett Brothers case and the Teague case involve governmental entities that have assumed control of development. The state, in the case of Barr, did not have any control over the development of the subject property. That was within the jurisdiction of the City of Austin. It's the City of Austin that approved that site plan. It's the City of Austin that said that site plan is now expired and you cannot develop your property.
Because
that's a critical distinction.
Because the state would not approve it, isn't that right? It was a condition to the city acting that the state act also.
Okay. Justice Doggett, if you'll... after argument, if you'll look at my brief again on the front part where I disagree with the statement of facts,
right.
That's a critical distinction. Because if you distort facts to fit your theories, the facts will always fit those theories. And it's a critical thing to note, this is critical, that as part of that site development plan, there was no requirement by the City of Austin that this exchange occur. What happened is that the landowners, when they got their title policy, something fell through the cracks. And they didn't even know that the state owned that channel easement until 2 years after the site plan had been approved, when the engineer with the highway department called up the engineering firm hired by the landowners and said, hey, you're showing a building to be built over a channel easement, and they responded words to the effect, you've got to be kidding. So the key is, and with all due deference to Justice Smith, I would urge to the court that she's just flat mistaken when she says that one of the requirements of the site development plan was that an exchange occur. That was never even an issue in reality until 2 years after the site plan had been approved, and the reason it arose was the landowner suddenly found out, good night, we've gotten a site plan approved that shows a building to be built over the state's channel easement. And in the record, in front of the jury and in the statement of facts before this court, I asked Tom Ward, who was the engineer with the highway department, I said, what did you do when you discovered the conflict? He said, I called Cunningham Graves. And I said, were they aware of it when you called? He said, no. And I said, so that was the first time they were made aware of the fact that the state owned the channel easement. He said, yes. And I quote that in the brief.
Apart from the circumstances, though, of this case, I'm interested in the rule of law here, and I want to know what the state's position is on whether or not a governmental entity with the power of eminent domain can take action which it ordinarily would have the power to take, either police action in the form of zoning or rezoning or this kind of exchange of easements, as in this case, or some similar type of action, with the express purpose of decreasing the value of targeted property so that they would have to pay less compensation to eminent domain. Can a governmental entity do that?
All right. Number one, if the landowner doesn't have a property interest, then there can be no inverse condemnation. If equal protection requirements have been met, then the motive is irrelevant. For instance, the type of scrutiny that would apply here is whether it's rationally related, whether the governmental decision was rationally related. In the case at bar, the property that's in dispute has been owned by the state of Texas since 1955. It's been used since 1955 to handle drainage. It's being used for drainage today as I speak, and it will continue to be used for drainage after the completion of the widening and straightening of 2222.
And
therefore, it's rationally related.
And the engineer in this case said they could use the exchange just as easily as they could use what they had.
Okay, now that's another point that the Austin Court of Appeals would respectfully urge interpreted mistakenly. What the engineer said was, from an engineering point of view, that if the proposal was actually done. In other words, the topography was completely regraded, all the concrete riffraff was put in. Then once that was completed, from an engineering point of view, that would adequately convey the water. That's Tom Ward's language. But the key is, that was not an official act on the part of the state of Texas of approving the exchange. And Justice Smith says, after initial technical approval. And, you know, fortunately, for one time in my life, I saw an issue before it hit me in the face, and that's why I asked Tom Ward in front of the jury on the record, because I knew the jury wouldn't make any difference. I said, Mr. Ward, did you have the legal authority to approve this exchange? And he said, no, sir. I said, did you approve it? He said, no, sir.
But he did have the unique expertise on whether it would work or not. And if one piece will work, and just as well as another piece, on what basis is there for the state's refusal to approve the exchange?
Well, I would urge that it would be rationally related for the state to exercise its discretion as it saw fit to not approve an exchange like that because, let me give you an example. Interstate 35 runs from Austin to Dallas and it goes through Waco. Let's assume that I live in Grossbeck and I know that if the road goes through Grossbeck, I can open up a department store because there's going to be a lot of traffic there and the town will prosper. Well, you can get to Dallas from Austin by going through Grossbeck instead of going by Waco. But that doesn't give the landowners in Grossbeck the right to say, listen, federal government and the state of Texas, we've got all this land that we've put together that we're going to give you in exchange for the land where the interstate goes through Waco. We want to make a clean swap. We want to give you land that you can build the road and still get to Dallas, but it'll go through Grosvenor instead of going through Waco, and we want to make this exchange. Now, obviously, it would be very unsound public policy, in addition to the fact that in reality it would be ridiculous, but looking at it from a legal point of view, it'd be extremely unsound public policy to say to the state and to sue the state on the basis of, our proposal will work just as well as what you've got from a logistical point of view. People can still get from Austin to Dallas, but we want it done this way. Obviously, you've got to reach a point where you say, is the government's decisions rationally related? And if they are, then equal protection has been met. So motive is not really a key in determining whether it's rationally related. You have to look at the function of the piece of property involved. If the property is being used for the public purpose for which it's acquired, and it's continuing and will continue to be used for that purpose, motive becomes legally irrelevant.
So in short, the state can purposefully, even maliciously, take action to decrease the value of the targeted property as long as it's got some rationalization or rational basis for doing so.
Unless the property owner has a property interest in that exchange, or unless the government's action was not rationally related, then the landowner has no cause of action, no matter what the intent or motive is.
Any questions?
So the answer to Justice Doggett's question is, if they had a vested property right, you would answer his question unequivocally yes.
Based on inverse condemnation. Because with equal protection, you don't have to have a right to have a violation. For instance, if I applied for a job on this bench, assuming that you don't have to run for office, which you do, I don't have a legal right to your job, but if the job is opened and posted, I have a legal right to be interviewed and have the same process and criteria applied to me as to yourself or anyone else applying for the job. So that's another reason that the case gets a little confusing, because equal protection is a mutually exclusive legal issue from inverse condemnation.
No other questions, please.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
Okay, please, the court. Over the last three sessions of this court, you've had a flurry of takings cases to consider. And I think that in most of those cases, this court has treated those cases as ones in which the landowner, the property owner, was trying to push the envelope in terms of what was to be compensated. That's where the majority of decisions came down. This particular takings case is very different. In this takings case, there is not a question of pushing the envelope to provide new remedies or rights for the landowner. This is a case that in my 15 years of eminent domain takings issues presents the single most egregious, outrageous fact situation I have ever seen. The landowner here is not trying to push the envelope at all, but trying to protect the very minimum of guarantees of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution.
Do you agree that as a prerequisite to the exchange, you need to get the Commissioner's Court to approve the exchange?
As a prerequisite, under the state regulations, there was a requirement that the county give approval in some form or another. In this particular case, the state tried to argue to the jury that the reason the exchange was denied was because there was, in fact, no letter from the county. That was a fact issue that was presented to the jury. The jury said no to the state. The jury found that the reason the easement exchange was denied had nothing to do with any letter or approvals from Travis County. The state denied it in order to gain advantage in a condemnation case. And I would suggest, Justice, that this is a no-evidence case, and that in deciding the questions of law presented in this case, you have to assume the facts as not only as were found by the jury, but you have to assume that the facts as presented and if we support the cause of action are found. I would...
Let me ask you.
Attach to the... On your issue, Justina, this is Exhibit 9 that was submitted at trial, and it's tabbed at the back of the brief that we have submitted. This is the notes of the conversation that the landowner's agent had at the time of the easement exchange denial. Speaking with Mr. Murray, Mr. Murray didn't say anything about a denial occurring because he didn't get, and that has to be a resolution from the county, but in a phone call from the county attorney's office. Just some indication that the county wasn't right to oppose it. In the conversation with Mr. Murray, he says nothing about any letter from the county. He says, you're not going to get this. You're not going to be able to save your site plan in this case because it's not in the best interest of the state or Travis County. And it's because the landowners failed to cooperate with Travis County by refusing their offer for the purchase of the right-of-way.
Are you saying that under the Fifth Amendment, it makes no difference whether your clients had a vested property right or not?
Under the Fifth Amendment, you have to have a vested property right in the property that is damaged.
If your client did not have a vested property right, then you lose on the inverse condemnation issue?
No, sir. You do not need to have a vested property right in the easement exchange itself. And in fact, you do not claim a vested property right in the easement exchange itself. You have to have a vested property right in the easement exchange itself if you want to prevail under a substantive due process or a procedural due process claim argument. You do not have to have a vested property right, as Mr. Heidenheimer said, in the thing itself if you're raising an action under equal protection. And similarly, in the cases cited to you in the brief that I gave to the court a week ago, you do not need a vested property right in the exchange itself to prevail under an inverse condemnation cause of action. So no, in this case, you do not need one, and we do not claim one in the easement exchange itself.
On Mr. Heidenheimer's hypothetical about moving the highway to Rosebud, how do we come to a conclusion that says there's inverse condemnation in this case without setting up Mr. Heidenheimer's hypothetical that I've got some land, I'm willing to build the highway, under your practice of always granting exchanges, you've now got to move I-35 over to Grossbeck, and if you refuse to do so, then the value of my property lining both sides of the highway now won't be realized, and so my property reverts to being whatever it is, agriculture, so I have been harmed by your refusal to move it. How do we decide in the results in this case in favor of your client without in fact saying that anyone who has open land can argue an exchange, and if they don't get the exchange, then they are immediately damaged based on what their property could have been worth had the exchange occurred?
Yes, Justice Lina. The crucial element that would prevent that landowner in Grossbeck from having a cause of action is the fact that the cause of action in this case is based on the fact that the denial was due to a desire to gain advantage in a condemnation case. It is the motivation or the purpose, it is the justification behind the denial that gives rise to the cause of action.
If the state doesn't pay the condemnation proceeds, how do they benefit from the condemnation?
In this particular case?
Yeah.
The state benefits on several grounds. The state kept arguing that it didn't have an interest in the condemnation matter in this case, and that's belied by the language that the state has in the letters they sent to the landowner where they said we're denying this easement exchange because of the state's interest. The state hasn't had a financial interest in the case itself. In evidence was the fact that the state stepped forward to buy the Mopac South right-of-way when the county couldn't afford to buy it. So if the county was not able to afford the right-of-way, the state would step in and buy it. Also, the state had the financial obligation to design the road. Apart from those direct financial interests, the state was the party to actually get title to the property after it was acquired, not Travis County. Travis County was merely acting as the acquisition agent in essence for Travis County. Beyond that, the county didn't do anything wrong here. The county was not the one that denied the easement exchange. The state had the control. The state had the power. The state is the one that did the wrong, that had the ability to do the wrongful conduct, and in fact did the wrongful conduct.
So if the state has a benefit in the from the denial, then that's the difference between Mr. Heidenheimer's
hypothetical
situation.
I'm not sure that it's so much the benefit. The Teague case said that we're going to find an inverse condemnation case where you physically take property, where you wholly destroy the value of property, or where the government acts in its own interest. But the T case also said that there is no one-sentence rule that defines all the instances where you have a taking. In this particular case, what the state did was wrong because it presented an unconstitutional condition for these landowners. These landowners were told by the state, if you accept the obviously an adequate offer that is being made to you, we'll give you the easement exchange. If, on the other hand, you want to proceed and prosecute your right to just compensation, then you don't get the easement exchange, and you're forced into an election. That's exactly the fact situation that occurred in the Parks v. Watson case, which is the case also mentioned in the brief. In this particular case, it's a Ninth Circuit federal case. It wasn't an easement exchange that was being sought, it was a vacation of easements that were being sought. Vacation, the roadway. And the court said the city may not condition, and the city was denying the vacation because there were some geothermal wells on the property that the government wanted to condemn. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit said the city cannot condition that vacation on the waiving of the Fifth Amendment claim to get just compensation for the acquisition of the geothermal wells. This Parks case is something that didn't concern a permit, which is another argument that the state makes. It concerns a vacation of property, which is virtually identical to an exchange of real property. This is a case in which the court specifically said you do not need a property interest in the vacation. You have no property right. You have no right to demand a vacation of interest just because you want it. All the government has to do is step forward with any rational basis for denying the vacation or the easement exchange or the rerouting of the road to Gross, any rational basis for doing it other than we want to acquire property that you have in an unrelated manner more cheaply. That reason is insufficient. The dissent in Parks v. Watson said that the majority was wrong, and the reason the dissent gave was that the dissent felt there should not be a relationship between the benefit sought, the vacation, and the condition imposed, the dedication of the geothermal well. The court said, hey, the state ought to be able to get the land more cheaply. All power to them, let them try. That was the dissent. The United States Supreme Court in the Nolan versus California Coastal Commission case answered that question. And it said, when you put a condition on something, be it a subdivision extraction for parkland dedication or whatever, when you put a condition, there has to be a relationship between the benefit being sought by the property owner and the condition that you're imposing. And the very first, and it cited 24 cases for that proposition. And the very first case that it cited for that proposition was the Parks v. Watson case. This is the United States Supreme Court speaking.
They did not hold that the state may not act in its own economic self-interest in these matters?
The state cannot act in its own economic self-interest. That's correct.
And that's the holding of Nolan?
The holding in Nolan is that the state has the right to demand granted easements, subdivision extractions, parkland dedications, and the like, from property owners when they come in and ask for granting of a permit, subdivision permit, or the like. But you can only do that if there is a relationship between the benefit being sought, subdivision permit, and the condition that you're imposing. There has to be some relationship. In the Nolan case, the court found that there was a legitimate reason for the government to want to have an easement across the beach so that the public could travel up and down the beach. And so that's a good goal. You have the right to go ahead and condemn that easement if you want to get it. But what we will not let you do is demand that the landowner dedicate that easement to go up and down the beach while he's asking for his building permit, because there's no relationship on the burden that he's imposing on the public and the benefit he's seeking. Contrast that with the other case that Nolan cited, and it was a Texas Supreme Court case, the Turtle Rock case, from this court, which was the other basis, one of other 24 bases other than Parks v. Watson that the Nolan court used. In that case here in Texas, and it was actually a precursor to Nolan, Texas actually had put this rational relationship test in place before Nolan came down, the landowner was complaining in his subdivision application that he was being asked to dedicate parks. And he challenged that. The Supreme Court sent the case back down to the trial court and said, we're going to let the government act in its interest and force the dedication of parkland, but only if you find that the burden that's being created, the court must consider whether there's a reasonable connection between the increased population arising from the subdivision development and the increased park and recreation needs in the neighborhood. Absent that connection, the condition of you have to dedicate something becomes an unconstitutional condition. It's a weighing test. In any condemnation case, in any kind of taking issue, the property owner has a right under the Fifth Amendment and under the Texas Constitution, Article 17, has a right to be paid for property that is damaged or taken from him. At the same time, the government has a right and a need to be able to govern and to regulate and do the things that its police powers require it to do for the good of the people. And there's a balancing test.
Mr. Adler, yes, I see it. It seems to me there's a difference from the government wanting to take an individual's property and negotiating over the ability of that person to develop the property the way they want to in an effort to force them to take less money for the property that's being taken. It seems to me that's different than when the government already has the property and a developer wants them to move that property and the government then decides for whatever reason it doesn't want its property moved. It seems to me that's just kind of the flip side. Your argument to apply would say that if the government has the power to move property, then it must move its property. Failure to do so results in damages to the property owner who could not otherwise develop their property because of
I guess what I'm saying, Zink, is the government has the discretion whether or not to give away its property, to do exchanges or vacations. It has the discretion to do that. But as soon as the government, who holds this land not as a private individual, but more in terms of a trustee for the public, when the government deigns to act on that discretion, when it decides it is going to grant easement exchanges, then it has to treat people with due regard to the Constitution. It can't say, we're going to give easement exchanges, our property, to somebody because, to all men, but we're not going to give it to women. The government can't say it's in our discretion, it's our property, we'll give it to people only of one race. They can't say we're going to give it to people if they're Republicans but not give it to them if they're Democrats. Once they decide to use the discretion and act with that power, then they have to do it with due constitutional regard. And the distinction that you're suggesting, or asking me to respond to, Justice Zinick, is a distinction that the state makes in its case, this property right distinction. And I would refer you again to the Parks v. Watson case, which was one in which this was approved, the opinion, the rationale was approved by the United States Supreme Court, was one in which the government was being asked to vacate streets, to give up its right in streets on a piece of property. And the government said, okay, we'll do that, but we're going to be tough negotiators. We want you to give up the geothermal wells for less than what they're worth, which is exactly the fact situation here.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, in the same rationale in Parks v. Watson, and the same balancing test that we use, that Nolan presents, is exactly the test that the two Texas cases, Barrett Brothers and T.
If the land development plan had not expired and the state merely delayed the exchange, what would have been the harm?
If the state had merely delayed the exchange, the damage
until they had taken property that was condemned?
I haven't really looked at measuring damages under that scenario, so I can't really speak to it. I would say, though, that in a temporary taking like that, or a temporary denial, the damages would be different. Also,
but there still would be inverse condemnation.
I don't know. There are special rules that apply when there is a temporary delay of something, as in a sewer moratorium or something like that, where there may or may not rise to the level of being a taking. But in this particular case, it was the state's goal and the state's intention to stop this site plan, and that's in fact what they did.
There will be circumstances where the entity with the power of eminent domain, usually the government, will may be in sort of a conflict situation. Prognosticate that maybe some land will be condemned at certain points, and if zoning rules change or permits are given, it may affect the values, and can't tell for sure, but maybe in the future someday this is going to affect that.
which, if it were a private entity, it might have to recuse from because of the possibility of conflict, but it can't because it's the government. What sort of explanation does the state have to offer to keep there from being liability in a case like this?
All the state has to do is come up with a rational reason for the denial of the exchange. A rational reason.
Unrelated to its self-interest.
I'm sorry?
Unrelated to its self-interest.
No, I think that all of its reasons are going to be related to its self-interest, but there has to be a rational reason that has a rational relationship to what the benefit being sought is. If I come to you to ask for an easement exchange and you deny me that, it has to be somehow or another related to the easement exchange request I have. You can't deny me because you saw me at a political fundraiser for someone that you didn't like. The state always acts in its self-interest. I'm not saying that's a wrong thing to do, but there just has to be a in order to extract it from me and not pay me just compensation, because the state has the right to condemn this roadway if they want to. If you're going to extract it from me, make me give it to you for less than what it's worth, and you tie that to a request I'm making from you, there has to be some relationship between the two. And that's why this case can be narrowly drawn. It's not going to give rise to flooded clay cases. This is a unique fact situation and an egregious fact situation.
Real quick, how much evidence is in the record about the state's conduct in similar situations?
The evidence
is just an illusion. They've never done this before, but is that fleshed out?
Yes, it is. I asked if there had ever been, if he knew of any denials of this kind of thing where someone had been able to meet the technical requirements, and the answer to that was none. No example, no instances of any.
Is there any evidence of how many times this had been done? I mean, how many times the state have been called on to make this kind of decision in the past?
I'm not sure that there's a total number. I mean, I know there were depositions in the case, and I'm not sure how much that went into. But there was evidence that these things were routinely granted. There were developers that say they routinely got these kinds of things. There were land planners that said these things are routinely obtained. You know, there's no reason why this one shouldn't have been obtained here. There was that kind of evidence from those kind of expert witnesses as well.
What, Mr. Adler, going back to my early question about the commissioner's approval.
Yes,
Mr. Heidenheimer said that you have to have a resolution of the commissioner's court approving the exchange. You answered, well, the jury didn't believe that. I mean, I don't know how that's a fact issue. Either you have to have a resolution in the commissioner's court or you don't. Are you saying when you met all the technical requirements that literally the state does not require a resolution in the commissioner's court? Or are you saying that they don't always require it and it wasn't necessary here?
The state regulations require the local jurisdictions involved to say we don't need the land either.
Okay.
In this particular case, the county people took the stand and said that they were never asked by the state to give them that approval. They were never asked by the state. And the county attorney said he knew no reason why the county wouldn't give it to them. Had they ever been asked to give it to them? That just was not an issue, and this is a red herring argument which is coming at this point in argument.
Following up on Justice Spector's question, if the state had merely dragged its feet until the site development plan approval expired of its own terms and thus the value of the property plummeted, would you be in the same posture
if the
during
state,
today as a result of their denial of the exchange of easements?
If the state could be shown to have dragged its feet solely for the purpose of trying to diminish or decrease the value of the property being condemned, I think then that might very well give rise to a cause of action. If the state can demonstrate that it dragged its feet for some other rational reason that they might have. In a sewer moratorium case, it's while they study to find out what the sewer capabilities will be or potential to be for succeeding years, then I think there would not necessarily be a cause of action. Again, the state keeps trying to define this case as one in which we are trying to decide whether or not the state has an obligation to give easement exchanges generally, and that's not what this case is about. This case is about whether the government can rig the market under the words of Garrett Brothers and act solely for the purpose to deny someone a constitutional right solely for the purpose of gaining advantage of the financial. That's the sole issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Could you respond to Counsel's last statement that that's the issue that defines this case?
I'm sorry, Jessica.
Could you respond to his closing statement that is the issue that defines this case?
It's
specifically, what did he say? Because I was thinking about what I was going to say.
Okay. I guess really cross-referencing back to the case that he referred to and suggesting that this is a question of the government's ability to essentially do anything it wants to take advantage of a condemnation case.
Well, it's not. There's a couple of reasons. Number one, the Garrett Brothers case and the Teague Brothers case dealt with a situation where the governmental defendant had assumed control of development through the permitting process.
So if the state had assumed control here, you believe that those cases would be controlled?
If the state had assumed control of the development and 6673A established a property right in the form of a permit, a license or permission that one is entitled to if you meet certain requirements, then absolutely they would apply. But in this case, we have two reasons why they don't apply. Number one, the state has not assumed control of development of the property, and in the case of Gar, had no control whatsoever over the development. That was in the city of Austin, who was never sued by the landowners. Secondly,
and we have to find no evidence of that for you to prevail. There's some evidence of that. We would at a minimum have to remand, because this is a no evidence review, and that's a factual.
Yes, sir, but it's the state's position that because there's a complete, that based on rules of law, you are barred from giving any credence to the facts established. In other words, it's the position of the state that taking every fact that they established, it's still legally irrelevant. I'm trying to remember, Justice Dockett, what your question was, because I had a second I know what it is. There's a second reason why they'd be inapplicable. Article 6673A does not create any type of interest or potential property interest in the landowners, and it does not create a situation that calls for equal protection scrutiny. And here's the reason. I'd like to direct the court's attention to Section 5 of Article 6673A, which is not in my brief. Section 5 of Article 6673A. And if I may, it states that in no event shall the right of the state of Texas to full and exclusive right of possession of all retained rights of way be infringed or lessened. That's the whole key. This is simply a mechanism for the state to dispose of its surplus property. It is not a mechanism in which the landowner has a property interest or an equal protection.
Respondent argues that all the state has to do is come up with a rational reason for its action. Is there one?
Yes, sir.
And it is?
We need the land. We have been using it for the public purpose for which it was acquired. We're using it today as I speak, and we will continue to use it in the future after the completion of the project. And just like the analogy that I made with the interstate going through Waco, just because they proposed an exchange that will, from an engineering perspective, work as well, that does not create a legal right that they have to force the state to involuntarily relinquish the property that we own and that we're using for the public purpose for which it was acquired.
I'd like to follow up on the question Justice Enoch asked the other side a little earlier relating to the county approval of the SDP. I may be mistaken, but I was under the impression that you were saying, or at least I think Justice Doggett put it in terms of Commissioner's Court being required to sign off on that, and your opponent said that's not so. What I think, if I understood him correctly, he just needed some expression from the county that it had no objections. It could have come from the county attorney or anyone with authority to give the county's position on such, didn't require formal resolution from the commissioner's court. I'm also laboring under the impression at this point that if that was necessary and the state is nothing by hook or by crook to influence the county's response, and the county declined to approve, we don't go any further. The rest of it is totally irrelevant because
the one thing that was absolutely necessary, the county's approval, didn't exist. Would you address that, embellish on that a little bit?
Well, that's exactly why Mr. Murray, at that point, terminated the exchange process. Basically, how this whole lawsuit arose was no good deed goes unpunished. The state had no economic interest in this exchange. What we owned and what we were using, we were perfectly happy with. But as a public servant and in an effort to try to work with these people, if it was viable and would work, he made the extra step. He went beyond the call of duty. And what happened is that based on a telephone conversation with the county, which was going to acquire the land at the county expense and not the state expense, based on a telephone conversation and based on the letter that he received, it was Mr. Murray's understanding that that resolution from the county commissioner's court formally announcing that this land was surplus to the needs of the county would never occur. So at that point...
Was a resolution from the commissioner's court necessary?
Yes, sir.
Where? Why? What provision of law?
The highway department has a set procedure that must be followed, and that was established in the statement of facts. And each one of these steps must be complied with, and at each level it must receive approval before an exchange can occur.
This is an existing internal regulation of the highway department that has been followed in every exchange that's taken place?
Yes, sir, and that gets back to what I was talking about, equal protection. The same process was applied to these landowners.
There's never been an exchange in the absence of a resolution?
No, sir. Absolutely not. So Mr. Murray did the common sense thing at that point. He said, why should we continue through with this process, wasting everybody's time and effort, when we know the commissioner's court isn't going to pass a resolution? And they never did. And the county was aware of what was going on because the county's attorneys were the ones that were talking with Mr. Murray.
Did the state do anything to influence the county's position?
No, sir, we didn't.
Any evidence that the state did anything to influence?
No, sir, there's not.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. That concludes the argument in this call, and that concludes the submissions for today. The foregoing clauses are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise.